deep voice, sigh.
How badly do you wish to know?
Lucas feared answering the question honestly. It isn't crucial, he said, but I would appreciate a sense of what we're accomplishing, what we survived. It feels like it gives us a purpose, you know?
The reason is the purpose,
the man said cryptically.
Before I tell you, I'd like to hear what you think.
Lucas swallowed. What I think?
Everyone has ideas. Are you suggesting you don't?
A hint of humor could be heard in that hollow voice. I think it was something we saw coming, Lucas said. He watched Bernard, who frowned and looked away.
That's one possibility.
Bernard removed his glasses and began wiping them on the sleeve of his undershirt, his eyes at his feet.
Consider this.
The deep voice paused.
What if I told you that there were only 50 silos in all the world, and that here we are in this infinitely small corner of it?
Lucas thought about this. It felt like another test.
I would say that we were the only ones.
He almost said that they were the only ones with the resources, but he'd seen enough in the legacy to know this wasn't true. Many parts of the world had buildings rising above their hills. Many more could have been prepared.
I'd say we were the only ones who knew,
Lucas suggested.
Very good. And why might that be?
He hated this. He didn't want to puzzle it out. He just wanted to be told. And then, like a cable splicing together, like electricity zipping through connections for the very first time, the truth hit him.
It's because...
He tried to make sense of this answer in his head, tried to imagine that such an idea could possibly verge on truth.
It's not because we knew, Lucas said, sucking in a gasp of air. It's because we did it.
Yes, the voice said. And now you know.
He said something else, just barely audible, like it was being said to someone else.
Our time is up, Lucas Kyle. Congratulations on your assignment.
The headphones were sticky against his head, his face clammy with sweat.
Thank you, he managed.
Oh, and Lucas?
Yes, sir.
Going forward, I suggest you concentrate on what's beneath your feet. No more of this business with the stars, okay, son? We know where most of them are.
16. Silo 18.
Hello? Solo? Please say something.
There was no mistaking that voice, even through the small speakers in the dismantled headset. It echoed bodiless in the control room, the same control room that had housed that very voice for so many years. The location was what nailed it for Shirley. She stared at the tiny speakers spliced into the magical radio, knowing it could be no one else. Neither she nor Walker dared breathe. They waited what felt like forever before she finally broke the silence.
That was Juliet, she whispered. How can we... Is her voice trapped down here? In the air? How long ago would that have been?
Shirley didn't understand how any of the science worked. It was all beyond her pay grade. Walker continued to stare at the headset, unmoving, not saying a word, tears shining in his beard.
Are these ripples we're grabbing with the antenna, are they just bouncing around down here?
She wondered if the same was true of all the voices they'd heard. Maybe they were simply picking up conversations from the past. Was that possible? Like some kind of electrical echo? Somehow this seemed far less shocking than the alternative. Walker turned to her, a strange expression on his face. His mouth hung partway open, but there was a curl at the edges of his lips, a curl that began to rise.
It doesn't work like that, he said.
The curl transformed into a smile.
This is now. This is happening.
He grabbed Shirley's arm.
You heard it too, didn't you? I'm not crazy. That really was her, wasn't it? She's alive. She made it.
No. Shirley shook her head. Wack, what are you saying? That Juliet's alive? Made it where?
You heard.
He pointed to the radio.
Before, the conversations, the cleaning, there's more of them out there. More of us. She's with them, Shirley. This is happening right now.
Alive? Shirley stared at the radio, processing this. Her friend was still somewhere, still breathing. It had been so solid in her head, this vision of Juliet's body just over the hills, lying in silent repose, the wind flecking away at her. And now she was picturing her moving, breathing, talking into a radio somewhere. "Well, can we talk to her?" she asked. She knew it was a dumb question. But Walker seemed to startle, his old limbs jumping.
"Oh, God! God! Yes!"
He set the mishmash of components down on the floor, his hands trembling, but with what Shirley now read as excitement. The fear in both of them was gone, drained from the room, the rest of the world beyond that small space fading to meaninglessness. Walker dug into the parts bin. He dumped some tools out and pawed into the bottom of the container.
"No,"
he said. He turned and scanned the parts on the ground.
"No, no, no."
"What is it?" Shirley slid away from the string of components so he could better see. "What are we missing? There's a microphone right there." She pointed to the partially disassembled headphones.
"The transmitter. It's a little bored. I think it's on my workbench."
"I swiped everything into the bin." Her voice was high and tense. She moved toward the plastic bucket.
"My other workbench, it wasn't needed. All Jenks wanted was to listen in."
He waved at the radio.
"I did what he wanted. How could I have known I'd need to transmit?"
"You couldn't," Shirley said. She rested her hand on his arm. She could tell he was heading toward a bad place. She had seen him go there often enough, knew he had shortcuts he could take to get there in no time. "Is there anything in here we can use? Think, Wack. Concentrate." He shook his head, wagging his finger at the headphones.
"This mic is dumb. It just passes the sound through. Little membranes vibrating."
He turned and looked at her.
"Wait. There is something."
"Down here? Where?"
"The mining storehouse would have them. A transmitter."
He pretended to hold a box and twist a switch.
"For the blasting caps. I repaired one just a month ago. It would work."
Shirley rose to her feet. "I'll go get it," she said. "You stay here."
"But the stairwell."
"I'll be safe. I'm going down, not up." He bobbed his head. "Don't change anything with that," she pointed to the radio. "No looking for more voices. Just hers. Leave it there."
"Well, of course."
Shirley bent down and squeezed his shoulder. "I'll be right back." Outside, she found dozens of faces turning her way, frightened and questioning looks in their wide eyes, their slack mouths. She felt like shouting over the hum of the generator that Juliet was alive, that they weren't alone, that other people lived and breathed in the forbidden outside. She wanted to, but she didn't have the time. She hurried to the rail and found Courtney.
"Hey."
"Everything okay in there?" Courtney asked.
"Yeah, fine. Do me a favor, will you? Keep an eye on Walker for me."
Courtney nodded.
"Where are you?"
But Shirley was already gone, running to the main door. She squeezed through a group huddled in the entranceway. Jenkins was outside with Harper. They stopped talking as she hurried past.
"Hey."
Jenkins seized her arm.
"Where the hell are you going?"
"Mine storeroom." She twisted her arm out of his grasp.
"I won't be long." "You won't be going. We're about to blow that stairwell. These idiots are falling right into our hands."
"Your what?"
"The stairwell," Harper repeated. "It's rigged to blow once they get down there and start working their way through."
He put his hands together in a ball, then expanded the sphere in a mock explosion.
You don't understand. She faced Jenkins. It's for the radio.
He frowned.
Walk had his chance.
We're picking up a lot of chatter, she told him. He needs this one piece. I'll be right back, swear.
Jenkins looked to Harper.
How long before we do this?
5 minutes, sir.
His chin moved back and forth, almost imperceptibly.
You've got 4, he said to Shirley. But make sure.
She didn't hear the rest. Her boots were already pounding the steel, carrying her toward the stairwell. She flew past the oil rig with its sad and lowered head, past the row of confused and twitching men, their guns all pointing the way. She hit the top of the steps and slid around the corner. Someone half a flight up yelled an alarm. Shirley caught a glimpse of 2 miners with sticks of TNT before she skipped down the flight of stairs. At the next level, she turned and headed for the mine shaft. The hallways were silent, just her panting and the clop, clop, clop of her boots.
Juliet, alive! A person sent to cleaning, alive!
She turned down the next hallway and ran past the apartments for the deep workers, the miners and the oil men, men who now bore guns instead of holes in the earth, who wielded weapons rather than tools. And this new knowledge, this impossible bit of news, this secret, it made the fighting seem surreal, petty. How could anyone fight if there were places to go beyond these walls? If her friend was still out there, shouldn't they be going as well? She made it to the storeroom, probably been 2 minutes. Her heart was racing. Surely Jenkins wouldn't do anything to that stairway until she got back. She moved down the shelves, peering in the bins and drawers. She knew what the thing looked like. There should be several of them floating about. Oh, where were they? She checked the lockers, threw the dingy coveralls hanging inside them to the ground, tossed work helmets out of the way. She didn't see anything. How much time did she have? She tried the small foreman's office next, throwing the door open and storming to the desk. Nothing in the drawers. Nothing on the shelves mounted to the wall. One of the big drawers on the bottom was stuck, locked. Shirley stepped back and kicked the front of the metal drawer with her boot. She slammed the steel toe into it once, twice. The lip curled down away from the drawer above. She reached in, yanked the flimsy lock off its lip, and the warped drawer opened with a groan. Explosives. Sticks of dynamite. There were a few small relays that she knew went into the sticks to ignite them. Beneath these, she found 3 of the transmitters Walker was looking for. Shirley grabbed 2 of them, a few relays, and put them all in her pocket. She took 2 sticks of the dynamite, just because they were there and went with everything else, and ran out of the office, through the storeroom, back toward the stairs. She had used up too much time. Her chest felt cool and empty, raspy as she labored to breathe. She ran as fast as she could, concentrating on throwing her boots forward, lunging for more floor, gobbling it up. Turning at the end of the hall, she again thought about how ridiculous this fighting was. It was hard to remember why it had begun. Knox was gone, so was McLean. Would their people be fighting if these great leaders were still around? Would they have done something different long ago? Something more sane? She cursed the folly of it all as she reached the stairs. Surely it had been 5 minutes. She waited for a blast to ring out above her, to deafen her with the concussive ferocity trapped in that stairwell. Leaping up 2 treads at a time, she made the turn at the top and saw that the miners were gone. Anxious eyes peered at her over homemade barrels.
Go!
Someone yelled, waving their arms to the side, hurrying her along. Shirley focused on Jenkins, who crouched down with his own rifle, Harper by his side. She nearly tripped over the wires leading away from the stairwell as she ran toward the 2 men.
"Now!" Jenkins yelled.
Someone threw a switch. The ground lurched and buckled beneath Shirley's feet, sending her sprawling. She landed hard on the steel floor, her chin grazing the diamond plating, the dynamite nearly flying from her hands. Her ears were still ringing as she got to her knees. Men were moving behind the railing, guns popping into the bank of smoke leaking from a new maw of twisted and jagged steel. The screams of the distant wounded could be heard on the other side. While men fought, Shirley padded her pockets, fished inside for the transmitters. And again, the noise of war seemed to fade, to become insignificant. She hurried through the door to the generator room, back to Walker, her lip bleeding, her mind on more important things. 17. Silo 17. Juliet pulled herself through the cold, dark waters, bumping blindly against the ceiling, a wall, no way to tell which. She gathered the limp air hose with blind and desperate lunges, no idea how fast she was going, until she crashed into the stairs. Her nose crunched against the inside of her helmet, and the darkness was momentarily shouldered aside by a flash of light. She floated, dazed, the air hose drifting from her hands. Juliet groped for the precious line as her senses gradually returned. She hit something with her glove, grabbed it, and was about to pull herself along when she realized it was the smaller power line. She let go and swept her arms in the blind murk, her boots bumping against something. It was impossible to know top from bottom. She began to feel turned around, dizzy, disoriented. A rigid surface pressed against her. She decided she must be floating up, away from the hose. She kicked off what she assumed was the ceiling and swam in the direction that she hoped was down. Her arms tangled in something. She felt it across her padded chest. She found it with her hands, expecting the power cord, but was rewarded with the spongy nothingness of the empty air tube. It no longer offered her air, but it did lead the way out. Pulling one direction gathered slack, so she tried the other way. The hose went taut. She pulled herself into the stairs again, bounced away with a grunt, and kept gathering line. The hose led up and around the corner, and she found herself pulling, reaching out an arm to fend off the blind assaults from walls, ceilings, steps, bumping and floating up 6 flights, a battle for every inch, a struggle that seemed to take forever. By the time she reached the top, she was out of breath and panting. And then she realized she wasn't out of breath, she was out of air. She had burned through whatever remained in the suit. Hundreds of feet of exhausted hose lay invisible behind her, sucked dry. She tried the radio again as she pulled herself through the corridor, her suit rising slowly toward the ceiling, not nearly as buoyant as before.
Solo, can you hear me?
The thought of how much water still lay above her, all those levels of it pressing down, hundreds of feet of solid flood, it was suffocating. What did she have left in the suit? Minutes? How long would it take to swim or float to the top of the stairwell? Much, much longer. There were probably oxygen bottles down one of those pitch-black hallways, but how would she find them? This wasn't her home. She didn't have time to look. All she had was a mad drive to reach the stairwell, to race to the surface. She pulled and kicked her way around the last corner and into the main hallway, her muscles screaming from being used in new ways, from fighting the stiff and bulky suit, the viscous atmosphere, when she realized the inky water had lightened to something nearer charcoal instead of pitch black. There was a green tint to her blindness. Juliet scissored her legs and gathered in the tubing, bumping along the ceiling, sensing the security station and stairwell ahead. She had traveled corridors like these thousands of times, twice in utter darkness, when main breakers had failed. She remembered staggering through hallways just like this, telling co-workers it would be okay, to just stay still, she'd handle it. Now she tried to do the same for herself. To lie and say it would all be okay. To just keep moving. Don't panic. The dizziness began to set in as she reached the security gate. The water ahead glowed lime green and looked so inviting. An end to the blind scrambling. No more of her helmet bumping into what she couldn't see. Her arm briefly tangled with the power cord. She shook it free and hauled herself toward that tall column of water ahead, that flooded straw, that sunken stairway. Before she got there, she had her first spasm, like a hiccup, a violent and automatic gasp for air. She lost her grip on the line and felt her chest nearly burst from the effort of breathing. The temptation to shed her helmet and take a deep inhalation of water overpowered her. Something in her mind insisted she could breathe the stuff. "Just give her a chance," it said. One lungful of the water, anything other than the toxin she had exhaled into her suit, a suit designed to keep such things out. Her throat spasmed again, and she started coughing in her helmet as she pulled her way into the stairwell. The rope was there, held down by the wrench. She swam for it, knowing it was too late. As she yanked down, she felt the slack coming. The loose end of the rope spiraled in sinking knots toward her. She drifted slowly toward the surface, very little of the built-up pressure inside her suit. No quick ride to the top. Another throat spasm, and the helmet had to come off. She was getting dizzy. Would soon pass out. Juliet fumbled for the clasps on her metal collar. The sense of déjà vu was overpowering. Only this time, she wasn't thinking clearly. She remembered the soup, the fetid smell, crawling out of the dark walk-in. She remembered the knife. Patting her chest, she felt the handle sticking out from its sheath. Some of her other tools had wiggled out of their pockets. They dangled from lines meant to keep them from getting lost, lines that now just made them a nuisance, turned them into more weights holding her down. She rose gently up the stairwell, her body shivering from the cold and convulsing from the absence of breathable air. Forgetting all reason, all sense of where she was, she became singularly aware of the noxious fog hanging all around her head, trapped by that dome. Killing her. She aimed the blade into the first latch in her collar and pressed hard. There was a click and a fine spray of cold water against her neck. A feeble bubble lurched out of her suit and tumbled up her visor. Groping for the other latch, she shoved the knife into it, and the helmet popped off, water flooding over her face, filling her suit, shocking her with the numbing cold and dragging her, sinking, back down to where she'd come from. The freezing cold jolted Juliet to her senses. She blinked her lids against the sting of the green water and saw the knife in her hands, the dome of her helmet spinning through the murk like a bubble heading in the wrong direction. She was slowly sinking after it, no air in her lungs, hundreds of feet of water pressing down. She jabbed the knife into the wrong pocket on her chest, saw drivers and spanners hanging by their cords from her struggle through the blackness, and kicked toward the hose that still led through four levels of water toward the surface. Bubbles of air leaked out of her collar and across her neck, up through her hair. Juliet seized the hose and stopped her plummet, pulled upward, her throat screaming for an intake of air, of water, of anything. The urge to swallow was overpowering. She started to pull herself up when she saw, in the undersides of the steps, a shimmering flash of hope. Trapped bubbles. Maybe from her descent. They moved like liquid solder in the hollow undersides of the spiral staircase. Juliet made a noise in her throat, a raw cry of desperation, of effort. She pawed through the water, fighting the sinking of the suit, and grasped the railing of the submerged stairway. Pulling herself up and kicking off of the railing, she made it to the nearest shimmer of bubbles, grabbed the edge of the stairs and pushed her mouth right up to the metal underside of the step. She inhaled a desperate gasp of air and sucked in a lot of water in the process. She dove her head below the surface and coughed into the water, which brought the burn of fluids invading her nose. She nearly sucked in a lungful of water, felt her heart racing and ready to burst out of her chest, stuck her face back up against the wet, rusty underside of that step, and with her lips pursed and trembling, managed to take in a gentle sip of air. The tiny flashes of light in her vision subsided. She lowered her head and blew out, away from the step, watching the bubbles of her exhalation rise, and then pressed her face close for another taste. Air. She blinked away underwater tears of effort, of frustration, of relief. Peering up the twisted maze of metal steps, many of them moving like flexible mirrors where the trapped air was stirred by her mad gyrations, she saw a pathway like no other. She kicked off and took a few steps at a time, pulling herself hand over hand in the gaps between, drinking tiny bubbles of air out of the several-inch hollow beneath each tread, praising the tight welds where the diamond plate steps had been joined many hundreds of years ago. The steps had been boxed in for strength, to handle the traffic of a million impacts of boots, and now they held the gaseous overflow from her descent. Her lips brushed each one, tasting metal and rust, kissing her salvation. The green emergency lights all around her remained steady, so Juliet never noticed the landings drifting past. She just concentrated on taking 5 steps with each breath, 6 steps, a long stretch with hardly any air, another mouthful of water where the bubble was too thin to breathe, a lifetime of rising against the tug of her flooded suit and dangling tools, no thought for stopping and cutting things free, just kick and pull, hand over hand, up the undersides of the steps. A deep and steady pull of air. Suck this shallow step dry. Don't exhale into the steps above. Easy now. 5 more steps. It was a game, like hop. 5 squares and a leap. Don't cheat. Mind the chalk. She was good at this. Getting better. And then a foul burn on her lips, the taste of water growing toxic, her head coming up into the underside of a step and breaking through a film of gas stench and slimy oil. Juliet blew out her last breath and coughed, wiping at her face, her head still trapped below the next step. She wheezed and laughed and pushed herself away, banging her head on the sharp steel edge of the stairs. She was free! She briefly bobbed below the surface as she swam around the railing, her eyes burning from the oil and gas floating on top. Splashing loudly, crying for Solo, she made it over the railing. With her padded and shivering knees, she finally found the steps. She'd made it! Clinging to the dry treads above her, neck bent, gasping and wheezing, her legs numb, she tried to cry out that she made it, but it escaped as a whimper. She was cold. She was freezing. Her arms shivered as she pulled herself up the quiet steps. No rattle from the compressor. No arms reaching to assist her. Solo? Solo? She crawled the half-dozen treads to the landing and rolled onto her back. Some of her tools were caught on the steps below. She crawled the half-dozen treads to the landing and rolled onto her back. Some of her tools were caught on the steps below, tugging at her where they were tied off to her pockets. Water drained out of her suit and splashed down her neck, pooled by her head, ran into her ears. She turned her head. She needed to get the freezing suit off, and found Solo. He was lying on his side, eyes shut, blood running down his face, some of it already caked dry. Solo? Her hand was a shivering blur as she reached and shook him. What had he done to himself? Hey, wake the fuck up. Her teeth were chattering. She grabbed his shoulder and gave him a violent shake.
Solo, I need help.
One of his eyes parted a little. He blinked a few times, then bent double and coughed, blood flecking the landing by his face.
Help,
she said. She fumbled for the zipper at her back, not realizing it was Solo who needed her. Solo coughed into his hand, then rolled over and settled once again to his back. The blood on his head was still flowing from somewhere, fresh tracks trickling across what had dried some time before.
Solo!
He groaned. Juliet pulled herself closer. She could barely feel her body. He whispered something, his voice a rasp on the edge of silence.
Hey!
She brought her face close to his, could feel her lips swollen and numb, could still taste the gasoline.
My name...
He coughed a mist of red. One arm lifted from the landing a few inches as if to cover his mouth, but it never had a chance of getting there.
My name,
he said again. His head lolled side to side, and Juliet finally realized that he was badly injured. Her mind began to clear enough to see what state he was in.
Hold still, she groaned.
Solo, I need you to be still. She tried to push herself up, to will herself the strength to move. Solo blinked and looked at her, his eyes glassy, blood tinting the gray in his beard the color crimson.
Not Solo,
he said, his voice straining.
My name's Jimmy.
More coughing. His eyes rolled up into the back of his head.
And I don't think...
His eyelids sagged shut, and then he squinted in pain.
Don't think I was...
Stay with me,
Juliet said, hot tears cutting down her frozen face.
Don't think I ever was alone,
he whispered. The lines on his face relaxing, his head sagging to the cold steel landing. 18. Silo 18. The pot on the stove bubbled noisily, steam rising off the surface, tiny drops of water leaping to their hissing freedom over the edge. Lucas shook a pinch of tea leaves out of the resealable tin and into the tiny strainer. His hands were shaking as he lowered the little basket into his mug. As he lifted the pot, some water spilled directly on the burner. The drops made spitting sounds and gave off a burnt odor. He watched Bernard out of the corner of his eye as he tilted the boiling water through the leaves.
"I just don't understand," he said, holding the mug with both hands, allowing the heat to penetrate his palms. "How could anybody... How could you do something like this on purpose?"
He shook his head and peered into his mug where a few intrepid shreds of leaf had already gotten free and swam outside the basket. He looked up at Bernard.
"And you knew about this? How could you know about this?"
Bernard frowned. He rubbed his mustache with one hand, the other resting in the belly of his coveralls.
"I wish I didn't know it," he told Lucas. "And now you see why some facts, some bits of knowledge have to be snuffed out as soon as they form. Curiosity would blow across such embers and burn this silo to the ground."
He looked down at his boots.
"I pieced it together much as you did, just knowing what we have to know to do this job. This is why I chose you, Lucas. You and a few others have some idea what's stored on these servers. You're already prepped for learning more. Can you imagine if you told any of this to someone who wears red or green to work every day?"
Lucas shook his head.
It's happened before, you know. Silo 10 went down like that. I sat back there.
He pointed toward the small study with the books, the computer, the hissing radio.
And I listened to it happen. I listened to a colleague's shadow broadcast his insanity to anyone who would listen.
Lucas studied his steeping tea. A handful of leaves swam about on hot currents of darkening water. The rest remained in the grip of the imprisoning basket.
That's why the radio controls are locked up, he said. And it's why you are locked up.
Lucas nodded. He'd already suspected as much.
How long were you kept in here?
He glanced up at Bernard and an image flashed in his mind, one of Sheriff Billings inspecting his gun while he visited with his mother. Had they been listening in? Would he have been shot, his mother too, if he'd said anything?
I spent just over 2 months down here until my caster knew I was ready, that I had accepted and understood everything I'd learned.
He crossed his arms over his belly.
I really wish you hadn't asked the question, hadn't put it together so soon. It's much better to find out when you're older.
Lucas pursed his lips and nodded. It was strange to talk like this with someone his senior, someone who had known so much more, was so much wiser. He imagined this was the sort of conversation a man had with his father, only not about the planned and carried-out destruction of the entire world. Lucas bent his head and breathed in the smell of the steeping leaves. The mint was like a direct line through the trembling stress, a strike to the calm pleasure center in the deep regions of his brain. He inhaled it and held it, finally letting it out. Bernard crossed to the small stove in the corner of the storeroom and started making his own mug.
How did they do it? Lucas asked. To kill so many? Do you know how they did it?
Bernard shrugged. He tapped the tin with one finger, shaking out a precise amount of tea into another basket.
They might be still doing it, for all I know. Nobody talks about how long it's supposed to go on. There's fear that small pockets of survivors might be holed up elsewhere around the globe. Operation 50 is completely pointless if anyone else survives. The population has to be homogeneous.
The man I spoke to, he said we were it, just the 50 silos.
47, Bernard said. And we are it, as far as we know. It's difficult to imagine anyone else being so well prepared. But there's always a chance. It's only been a few hundred years.
A few hundred?
Lucas leaned back against the counter. He lifted his tea, but the mint was losing its power to reach him. So hundreds of years ago, we decided...
They.
Bernard filled his mug with still steaming water.
They decided. Don't include yourself. Certainly don't include me.
Okay. They decided to destroy the world. Wipe everything out. Why?
Bernard set his mug down on the stove to let it steep. He pulled off his glasses, wiped the steam off them, then pointed them toward the study, toward the wall with the massive shelves of books.
Because of the worst parts of our legacy, that's why. At least that's what I think they would say if they were still alive.
He lowered his voice and muttered,
"Which they aren't, thank God."
Lucas shuddered. He still didn't believe anyone would make that decision, no matter what the conditions were like. He thought of the billions of people who supposedly lived beneath the stars all those hundreds of years ago. Nobody could kill so many. How could anyone take that much life for granted?
And now we work for them,
Lucas spat. He crossed to the sink and pulled the basket out of his mug, set it on the stainless steel to drain. He cautioned a sip, slurping lest it burn him.
You tell me not to include us, but we're part of this now.
No.
Bernard walked away from the stove and stood in front of the small map of the world hanging above the dinette.
We weren't any part of what those crazy fucks did. If I had those guys, the men who did this, if I had them in a room with me, I'd kill every last goddamned one of them.
Bernard smacked the map with his palm.
I'd kill them with my bare hands.
Lucas didn't say anything. Didn't move.
They didn't give us a chance. That's not what this is.
He waved at the room around them.
These are prisons. Cages, not homes. Not meant to protect us, but meant to force us, by pain of death, to bring about their vision.
Their vision for what?
For a world when we're too much the same, when we're too tightly invested in each other to waste our time fighting, to waste our resources guarding those same limited resources.
He lifted his mug and took a noisy sip.
That's my theory, at least. From decades of reading. The people who did this, they were in charge of a powerful country that was beginning to crumble. They could see the end, their end, and it scared them suicidal. As the time began to run out, over decades, keep in mind, they figured they had one chance to preserve themselves, to preserve what they saw as their way of life. And so, before they lost the only opportunity they might ever have, they put a plan into motion.
Without anybody knowing? How? Bernard took another sip. He smacked his lips and wiped his mustache.
Who knows? Maybe nobody could believe it anyway. Maybe the reward for secrecy was inclusion. They built other things in factories bigger than you can imagine that nobody knew about. They built bombs in factories like these that I suspect played a part in all this. All without anyone knowing. And there are stories in the legacy about men from a long time ago in a land with great kings, like mayors with many more people to rule. When these men died, elaborate chambers were built below the earth and filled with treasure. It required the work of hundreds of men. Do you know how they kept the locations of these chambers a secret?
Lucas lifted his shoulders. They paid the workers a ton of chits? Bernard laughed. He pinched a stray tea leaf off his tongue.
They didn't have chits. No, they made perfectly sure these men would keep quiet. They killed them.
Their own men? Lucas glanced toward the room with the books, wondering which tin this story was in.
It's not beyond us to kill, to keep secrets.
Bernard's face hardened as he said this.
It'll be a part of your job one day, when you take over.
Lucas felt a sharp pain in his gut as the truth of this hit. He caught the first glimmer of what he'd truly signed on for. It made shooting people with rifles seem an honest affair.
We are not the people who made this world, Lucas. But it's up to us to survive it. You need to understand that.
We can't control where we are right now. He mumbled. Just what we do going forward.
Wise words.
Bernard took another sip of tea. Yeah, I'm just beginning to appreciate them. Bernard set his cup in the sink and tucked a hand in the round belly of his coveralls. He stared at Lucas a moment, then looked again to the small map of the world.
Evil men did this, but they're gone. Forget them. Just know this. They locked up their brood as a fucked-up form of their own survival. They put us in this game, a game where breaking the rules means we all die, every single one of us. But living by those rules, obeying them, means we all suffer.
He adjusted his glasses and walked over to Lucas, patted him on the shoulder as he went past.
I'm proud of you, son. You're absorbing this much better than I ever did. Now get some rest. Make some room in your head and heart. Tomorrow, more studies.
He headed toward the study, the corridor, the distant ladder. Lucas nodded and remained silent. He waited until Bernard was gone, the muted clang of distant metal telling him that the grate was back in place, before walking through to the study to gaze up at the big schematic, the one with the silos crossed out. He peered at the roof of Silo 1, wondering just who in the hell was in charge of all this,
and whether they too could rationalize their actions as having been foisted upon them, as not really being culpable but just going along with something they'd inherited, a crooked game with rat-shit rules and most everyone kept ignorant and locked up. Who the fuck were these people? Could he see himself being one of them? How did Bernard not see that he was one of them? 19. Silo 18. The door to the generator room slammed shut behind her, dulling the patter of gunfire to a distant hammering. Shirley ran toward the control room on sore legs, ignoring her friends and co-workers asking her what was going on outside. They cowered along the walls and behind the railing from the loud blast and the sporadic gunfire. Just before she reached the control room, she noticed some workers from second shift on top of the main generator, toying with the rumbling machine's massive exhaust system.
"I got it,"
Shirley wheezed, slamming the control room door shut behind her. Courtney and Walker looked up from the floor. The wide eyes and slack jaw on Courtney's face told Shirley she'd missed something.
"What?"
she asked. She handed the two transmitters to Walker. "Did you hear? Walk, does she know?"
"How is this possible?" Courtney asked. "How did she survive? And what happened to your face?"
Shirley touched her lip, her sore chin. Her fingers came away wet with blood. She used the sleeve of her undershirt to dab at her mouth.
"If this works,"
Walker grumbled, fiddling with one of the transmitters,
"we can ask Jules herself."
Shirley turned and peered through the control room's observation window. She lowered her sleeve away from her face. "What's Carl and them doing with the exhaust feed?" she asked.
"They've got some plan to reroute it," Courtney said.
She got up from the floor while Walker started soldering something, the smell reminding her of his workshop. He grumbled about his eyesight while Courtney joined her by the glass. "Reroute it where?"
"IT? That's what Helene said, anyway. The cooling feed for their server room runs through the ceiling here before shooting up the mechanical shaft. Someone spotted the proximity on a schematic, thought of a way to fight back from here."
"So we choke them out with our fumes?" Shirley felt uneasy with the plan. She wondered what Knox would say if he were still alive, still in charge. Surely all the men and women riding desks up there weren't the problem. "Walk, how long before we can talk? Before we can try and contact her?"
"Almost there, blasted magnifiers."
Courtney rested her hand on Shirley's arm.
"Are you okay? How are you holding up?"
"Me?" Shirley laughed and shook her head. She checked the bloodstains on her sleeve, felt the sweat trickling down her chest. "Well, I'm walking around in shock. I have no idea what the hell's going on anymore. My ears are still ringing from whatever they did to the stairwell. I think I screwed up my ankle, and I'm starving. Oh, and did I mention my friend isn't as dead as I thought she was?" She took a deep breath. Courtney continued to stare at her worryingly. Shirley knew none of this was what her friend was asking her about. "And yeah, I miss Mark," she added quietly. Courtney put her arm around her friend and pulled her close.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I didn't mean to."
Shirley waved her off. The two of them stood quietly and watched through the window as a small crew from second shift worked on the generator, trying to reroute the outpouring of noxious fumes from the apartment-sized machine to the floors of the 30s high above. "You know what, though? There are times when I'm glad he's not here. Times when I know I won't be around much longer either. Not once they get to us, and I'm glad he's not here to stress about it, to worry about what they'll do to us, to me. And I'm glad I haven't had to watch him do all this fighting, living on rations, this sort of craziness." She dipped her chin at the crew outside. She knew Mark would either be up there leading that terrible work, or outside with a gun pressed to his cheek.
"Hello? Testing. Hello? Hello?"
The two women turned around to see Walker clicking the red detonate switch, the microphone from the headset held beneath his chin, furrows of concentration across his brow.
"Juliet?"
he asked.
"Can you hear me? Hello?"
Shirley moved to Walker's side, squatted down, rested a hand on his shoulder. The three of them stared at the headphones, waiting for a reply.
Hello.
A quiet voice leaked out of the tiny speakers. Shirley clapped a hand to her chest, her breath stolen from the miracle of a reply. It was a fraction of a second later, after this surge of desperate hope, that she realized this wasn't Juliet. The voice was different.
"That's not her,"
Courtney whispered, dejected. Walker waved his hand to silence her. The red switch clicked noisily as he prepared to transmit.
"Hello, my name is Walker. We received a transmission from a friend. Is there anyone else there?"
"Ask them where they are,"
Courtney hissed.
"Where exactly are you?"
Walker added, before releasing the switch. The tiny speakers popped.
"We are nowhere. You'll never find us. Stay away."
There was a pause, a hiss of static.
"And your friend is dead. We killed him."
Silo 17. The water inside the suit was freezing, the air cold, the combination lethal. Juliet's teeth chattered noisily while she worked the knife. She slid the blade into the soggy skin of the suit. The feeling of having been here before, having done all this once, unmistakable. The gloves came off first, the suit destroyed, water pouring out of every cut. Juliet rubbed her hands together, could barely feel them. She hacked away at the material over her chest, her eyes falling to Solo, who had gone deathly still. His large wrench was missing, she saw. Their supply bag was gone as well. The compressor was on its side, the hose kinked beneath it, fuel leaking from the loose filling cap. Juliet was freezing. She could hardly breathe. Once the chest of the suit was cut open, she wiggled her knees and feet through the hole, spun the material around in front of herself, then tried to pry the Velcro apart. Her fingers were too senseless to do even this. She ran the knife down the joint instead, sawing the Velcro apart until she could find the zipper. Finally, squeezing her fingers until they were white, she pulled the small tab until it was free of the collar. The collar off, she threw the suit away from herself. The thing weighed double with all the water in it. She was left in two layers of black undersuit, still soaking wet and shivering, a knife in her trembling hand, the body of a good man lying beside her. A man who had survived everything this nasty world could throw at him, except for her arrival. Juliet moved to Solo's side and reached for his neck. Her hands were icy. She couldn't feel a pulse. Wasn't sure if she would be able to. She could barely feel his neck with her frozen fingers. She struggled to her feet, nearly collapsed, hugged the landing's railing. She teetered toward the compressor, knowing she needed to warm up. She felt the powerful urge to go to sleep, but knew she'd never wake up if she did. The gas can was still full. She tried to work the cap, but her hands were useless. They were numb and vibrating from the cold. Her breath fogged in front of her, a chilly reminder of the heat she was losing, what little heat she had left. She grabbed the knife. Holding it in both hands, she pressed the tip into the cap. The flat handle was easier to grasp than the plastic cap. She spun the knife and cracked the lid on the jug of gas. Once the cap was loose, she pulled the blade out and did the rest with her palms, the knife resting in her lap. She tilted the can over the compressor, soaking the large rubber wheels, the carriage, the entire motor. She would never want to use it again anyway, never rely on it or anything else for her air. She put the can down, still half full, and slid it away from the compressor with her foot. Gas dripped through the metal grating and made musical impacts in the water below. Drips that echoed off the concrete walls of the stairwell,
that added to the flood's toxic and colorful slick. Wielding the knife with the blade down, the dull side away from her, she smacked it against the metal fins of the heat exchanger. She yanked her arm back with each strike, expecting the whoosh of an immediate flame. But there was no spark. She hit it harder, hating to abuse her precious tool, her only defense. Solo's stillness nearby was a reminder that she might need it if she were able to survive the deadly cold. The knife struck with a snick. There was a pop, heat traveling up her arm, a wash of it against her face. Juliet dropped the knife and waved her hand, but it wasn't on fire. The compressor was. Part of the grating, too. As it began to die down, she grabbed the can and sloshed some more. Large balls of orange flame rewarding her, leaping up in the air with a hiss. The wheels crackled as they burned. Juliet collapsed close to the fire, felt the heat from the dancing flame as it burned all across the metal machine. She began to strip, her eyes returning now and then to Solo, promising herself that she wouldn't leave his body there, that she would come back for him. Feeling slowly returned to her extremities, gradually, but then with a tingling pain. Naked, she curled into a ball next to the small and feeble fire and rubbed her hands together, breathing her warm and visible breath into her palms. Twice she had to feed the hungry and stingy fire. Only the wheels burned reliably, but they kept her from needing another spark. The glorious heat traveled somewhat through the landing's grated decking, warming her bare skin where it touched the metal. Her teeth chattered violently. Juliet eyed the stairs, this new fear coursing through her that boots could rumble down at any moment, that she was trapped between these other survivors and the freezing water. She retrieved her knife, held it in front of her with both hands, tried to will herself to not shiver so violently. Glimpses of her face in the blade caused her to worry more. She looked as pale as a ghost, lips purple, eyes ring-dark and seeming hollow. She nearly laughed at the sight of her lips vibrating, the clacking blur of her teeth. She scooted closer to the fire. The orange light danced on the blade. The unburnt fuel dripped and formed silvery splashes of color below. As the last of the gas burned and the flames dwindled, Juliet decided to move. She was still shaking, but it was cold in the depths of the shaft so far from the electricity of IT. She patted the black underlining she'd stripped off. One of them had been left balled up and was still soaked. The other she'd been lucky to have dropped flat. Hadn't been thinking clearly or she would have hung it up. It was damp, but better to wear it and heat it up than allow the cold air to wick her body temperature away. She worked her legs in, struggled to get her arms through the sleeves, zipped up the front. On bare, numb, and unsteady feet, she returned to Solo. She could feel his neck this time. He felt warm. She couldn't remember how long a body stayed that way, and then she felt a weak and slow thrumming in his neck, a beat. Solo! She shook his shoulders. Hey! What name had he whispered? She remembered. Jimmy! His head lolled from side to side while she shook his shoulder. She checked his scalp beneath all that crazy hair, saw lots of blood. Most of it was dry. She looked around again for her bag. They had brought food, water, and dry clothes for when she got back up, but the satchel was gone. She grabbed her other undersuit instead. She wasn't sure about the quality of the water in the fabric, but it had to be better than nothing. Wrenching the material in a tight ball, she dripped what she could against his lips. She squeezed more on his head, brushed his hair back to inspect the wound, probed the nasty cut with her fingers. As soon as the water hit the open gash, it was like pushing a button.
Solo lurched to the side, away from her hand and the drip from the undersuit. His teeth flashed yellow in his beard as he hissed in pain, his hands rising from the landing and hovering there, arms tensed, still senseless.
"Solo, hey, it's okay."
She held him as he came to, his eyes rolling around, lids blinking.
"It's okay," she said. "You're gonna be okay."
She used the balled-up undersuit to dab at his wound. Solo grunted and held her wrist but didn't pull away.
"Stings," he said.
He blinked and looked around.
"Where am I?"
"The down deep," she reminded him, happy to hear him talking. She felt like crying with relief.
I think you were attacked."
He tried to sit up, hissing between his teeth, a powerful grip pinching her wrist.
"Easy," she said, trying to hold him down. "You've got a nasty cut on your head, a lot of swelling."
His body relaxed.
"Where are they?"
he asked.
"I don't know," Juliet said. "What do you remember? How many were there?"
He closed his eyes. She continued to dab at his wound.
Just one, I think."
He opened his eyes as if shocked by the memory of the attack.
"He was my age."
"We need to get up top," she told him. "We need to get where it's warm. Get you cleaned up, get me dry. Do you think you can move?"
"I'm not crazy,"
Solo said.
"I know you're not."
"The things that move, the lights, it wasn't me. I'm not crazy."
"Nope," Juliet agreed.
She remembered all the time she had thought the same thing of herself, always in the down deep of this place, usually while rummaging around supply.
"You aren't crazy," she said, comforting him. "You aren't crazy at all."
21. Silo 18. Lucas couldn't force himself to study, not what he was supposed to be studying. The order sat flopped open on the wooden desk, the little lamp on its thousand-jointed neck bent over and warming it in a pool of light. But Lucas stood before the wall schematics instead. He stared at the arrangement of silos, spaced out like the servers in the room above him, and listened to the radio crackle with the sounds of distant warring. The final push was being made. Sims's team had lost a few men in an awful explosion, something about a stairwell, but not the great stairwell, and now they were in a fight they hoped would be the last. The little speakers by the radio hissed with static as the men coordinated themselves, as Bernard shouted orders from his office one level up, always with the crackle of gunfire erupting behind the voices. Lucas knew he shouldn't listen, and yet he couldn't stop. Juliet would call him any time now and ask him for an update. She would want to know what had happened, how the end had come, and the only thing worse than telling her would be admitting he didn't know, that he couldn't bear to listen. He reached out and touched the round roof of Silo 17. It was as though he were a god, surveying the structures from up high. He pictured his hand piercing the dark clouds above Juliet and spanning a roof built for thousands. He rubbed his fingers over the red X drawn across the silo, those two slashes that admitted to such a great loss. The marks felt waxy beneath his fingers, like they'd been drawn with crayon or something similar. He tried to imagine getting the news one day that an entire people were gone, wiped out. He would have to dig in Bernard's desk, his desk, and find the red stick, lash out another chance at their legacy, another pod of buried hope. Lucas looked up at the overhead lights, steady and constant, unblinking. Why hadn't she called? His fingernail caught on one of the red marks and flaked a piece of it away. The wax stuck under his fingernail. The paper beneath still stained the blood red. There was no taking it back, no cleaning it off, no making it whole again.
Gunfire erupted from the radio. Lucas went to the shelf where the little unit was mounted and listened to orders being barked, men being killed. His forehead went clammy with sweat. He knew how that felt, to pull that trigger, to end a life. He felt an emptiness in his chest and a weakness in his knees. Lucas steadied himself with the shelf, palms slick, and looked at the transmitter hanging there inside its locked cage. How he longed to call those men and women and tell them not to do it, to stop all the insanity, the violence, the pointless killing. There could be a red X on them all. This was what they should fear, not each other. He touched the metal cage that kept the radio controls locked away from him, feeling the truth of this and the silliness of broadcasting it to everyone else. It was naive. It wouldn't change anything. The short-term rage to be sated at the end of a barrel was too easy to act on. Staving off extinction required something else, something with more vision, something impossibly patient. His hand drifted across the metal grating. He peered inside at one of the dials, the arrow pointing to the number 18. There were 50 numbers in a dizzying circle, one for each silo. Lucas gave the cage a futile tug, wishing he could listen to something else. What was going on in all those other distant lands? Harmless things, probably. Jokes and chatter. Gossip. He could imagine the thrill of breaking in on one of those conversations and introducing himself to people who weren't in the know.
"I am Lucas, from Silo 18," he might say. And they would want to know why silos had numbers.
And Lucas would tell them to be good to each other, that there were only so many of them left, and that all the books and all the stars in the universe were pointless with no one to read them, no one to peer through the parting clouds for them. He left the radio alone, left it to its war, and walked past the desk and its eager pool of light spilling across that dreary book. He checked the tins for something that might hold his attention. He felt restless, pacing like a pig in its pen. He should go for another jog among the servers, but that would mean showering, and somehow showering had begun to feel like an insufferable chore. Crouching down at the far end of the shelves, he sorted through the loose, untinned stacks of paper there. Here was where the handwritten notes and the additions to the legacy had amassed over the years. Notes to future silo leaders, instructions, manuals, mementos. He pulled out the generator control room manual, the one Juliet had written. He had watched Bernard shelve the papers weeks ago, saying it might come in handy if the problems in the down deep went from bad to worse. And the radio was blasting the worse. Lucas went to his desk and bent the neck of the lamp so he could read the handwriting inside. There were days that he dreaded her calling, dreaded getting caught or Bernard answering or her asking him to do things he couldn't, things he would never do again. And now, with the lights steady overhead and nothing buzzing, all he wanted was a call. His chest ached for it. Some part of him knew that what she was doing was dangerous, that something bad could have happened. She was living beneath a red X, after all, a mark that meant death for anyone below it. The pages of the manual were full of notes she'd made with sharp lead. He rubbed one of them, feeling the grooves with his fingers. The actual content was inscrutable. Settings for dials in every conceivable order, valve positions, electrical diagrams. Rifling the pages, he saw the manual as a project not unlike his star charts, created by a mind not unlike his own. This awareness made the distance between them worse. Why couldn't they go back? Back to before the cleaning, before the string of burials. She would get off work every night and come sit with him while he gazed into the darkness, thinking and watching,
chatting and waiting. He turned the manual around and read some of the printed words from the play, which were nearly as indecipherable. In the margin sat notes from a different hand. Lucas assumed Juliet's mother, or maybe one of the actors. There were diagrams on some pages, little arrows showing movement. An actor's notes, he decided. Directions on a stage. The play must have been a souvenir to Juliet. This woman he had feelings for, whose name was in the title. He scanned the lines, looking for something poetic to capture his dark mood. As the text went by, his eyes caught a brief flash of familiar scrawl, not the actor's. He flipped back, looking for it a page at a time until he found it. It was Juliet's hand, no mistaking. He moved the play into the light so he could read the faded marks. "George, there you lay, so serene, the wrinkles in your brow and by your eyes nowhere seen. A touch when others look away, look for a clue, but only I know what happened to you. Wait for me, wait for me, wait there, my dear. Let these gentle pleas find your ear, and bury them there so this stolen kiss can grow on the quiet love that no other shall know." Lucas felt a cold rod pierce his chest. He felt his longing replaced by a flash of temper. Who was this George? A childhood fling? Juliet was never in a sanctioned relationship. He had checked the official